Hey there, Marco here. Before we start the show, I have some great news to share amongst all the chaos. We surpassed our end-of-year campaign goal. Yep, as you know, since October, we asked you every week to contribute to the work we're doing, and from across the globe, you answered the call. Together, we have raised over $130,000, a truly incredible show of support from you. Not only does it keep the engine of the production going, but it reminds our whole team that you are out there listening, and that what we do at The World matters to you. So from everyone here in our newsroom, we just can't thank you enough. Now, on to the show. On his way out the door, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is shaking up American foreign policy, including the way the U.S. deals with Taiwan.
You're inviting potentially chaos. You're inviting potential for mistakes to be made.
Also today, who is President-elect Biden's nominee for the next director of the CIA?
He is a soft-spoken individual, but his words carry tremendous weight and influence.
We hear about William Burns from a former director at the agency, and in Uganda, big worries about election violence as people prepare to vote on Thursday, and whether that violence is being directed from the top.
All signs point to the top, as in President Museveni.
Our reporter in Uganda has the latest. That and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Totally appropriate. That's how President Trump today described the speech he gave just ahead of the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol building. As he was about to board Air Force One en route to Texas, Trump spoke to reporters for the first time since the riot last week. He took a single question, spoke for less than 2 minutes, and he took no responsibility for what happened. Trump also tried to shift attention onto Democratic lawmakers for pursuing an article of impeachment.
For Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer to continue on this path, I think it's causing tremendous danger to our country, and it's causing tremendous anger. I want no violence.
There are just 8 days left before Joe Biden becomes president. One person who seems intent on using every last minute of that is Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. He's a busy man right now. Today, Pompeo gave a speech about links between Iran and Al-Qaeda.
You don't have to be a former CIA director to see the Iran-Al-Qaeda axis as a massive force for evil all across the world.
He offered little evidence, but Pompeo described Iran as the new national headquarters for Al-Qaeda. The U.S. intelligence community remains largely skeptical about the extent of that relationship. Pompeo today maintained that the threat has long been there, even if many people don't recognize it.
The time is now for America and all free nations to crush the Iran-Al-Qaeda axis. The Trump administration has actually made progress. Let's not tolerate Iran giving Al-Qaeda a second wind.
Iran's Foreign Minister Javad Zarif today dismissed as fictitious the idea that Iran has ties with Al-Qaeda. Pompeo's comments today are part of an all-out last-minute effort to cement his legacy as America's top diplomat, with a possible eye on a presidential run in 2024. He also recently lifted restrictions on diplomatic contacts between U.S. officials and Taiwan. More on that in a few minutes. But first, Cuba. Yesterday, Pompeo's State Department redesignated Cuba as a state sponsor of terrorism. Removing the country from the terrorism list was one of President Barack Obama's big foreign policy achievements. As The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia reports, it turns back the clock for the U.S. and for Cuba.
The process took a few years, but by 2016, a profound shift in U.S.-Cuba relations felt like it was here to stay.
Thank you so much. Please. Thank you very much. President Castro, people of Cuba, thank you so much for the warm welcome.
President Barack Obama stood in an auditorium in Havana with U.S. and Cuban flags waving behind him.
I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas.
Obama reestablished diplomatic relations with Cuba after decades of antagonism. He arranged for a prisoner exchange, allowed U.S. citizens to travel to the island more easily, and American University professor William Liogrand says Obama approved 22 agreements of mutual interest.
Ranging from environmental protection to counter-narcotics and counter-terrorism, as a matter of fact.
Working behind the scenes was then-Vice President Joe Biden. Now the president-elect will have to work extra hard if he wants to see those policies return. The Trump administration reversed many of them and, as of yesterday, returned Cuba to an unpopular club, the list of state sponsors of terrorism.
So I think it's in part President Trump trying to dismantle one of Obama's signature foreign policy achievements.
The Trump administration says Cuba is harboring U.S. fugitives and is refusing to hand over Colombian guerrilla leaders. But other countries have also given asylum to suspects wanted in the U.S. And the Colombian guerrillas were in Cuba for a peace negotiation that fell apart. So Leo Grant says,
those rationales are really disingenuous.
Trump and other Republicans have long courted voters in South Florida, where many Cuban Americans favor harsh policies toward Cuba's communist government. Ricardo Herrero heads the Cuba Study Group, an advocacy organization based in Washington, D.C. He says this may be a political move by Mike Pompeo, who's a former congressman and may be interested in the presidency himself.
The ones that look at Cuba in terms of numbers and voters in Florida elections, and this is just one more piece of candy to throw to those voters to show them that these politicians are on their side and to remember them come the next election.
But that would be a miscalculation, says Eduardo Gamarra, a political science professor at Florida International University in Miami. He says some surveys have shown Trump already has the support of more than half of Cuban American voters in Florida.
Right. It really is just preaching to the choir.
Regardless of the Trump administration's motives, there will be consequences to blacklisting Cuba. Gamarra says it will further isolate the country, and it will cost the United States some of the very little soft power it still has in Latin America.
We are no longer an example to anybody. We can't tell anybody not to be corrupt. We're just finishing one of the most corrupt administrations. We can't tell anybody to respect democracy. We just had an attempted coup here.
For Cuba, there are other consequences. For example, the designation may limit trade, and for the Biden administration, it could poison the waters on an island that is just 90 miles from the U.S. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
For America and China to have any hope of getting along, the U.S. must never cross a red line. That red line? The U.S. must never treat Taiwan as an independent country. In Beijing's eyes, the island belongs to China, period. Even though Taiwan effectively runs its own affairs as an independent democratic state. The U.S. has respected China's demands for four decades, but now Secretary of State Pompeo is upgrading diplomatic ties between the U.S. and Taiwan. Here's the World Southeast Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen.
The U.S. carries out a complicated dance with Taiwan, with do's and don'ts. Do sell billions of dollars worth of weaponry to the island to deter against a potential Chinese invasion. But don't ever, ever, ever say Taiwan is a sovereign country, because that will provoke China to invade. There are all these rules, because without rules,
you're inviting potentially chaos, you're inviting potential for mistakes to be made.
Drew Thompson was once beholden to those rules, helping guide Taiwan policy at the U.S. Defense Department. Now he's an analyst at the National University of Singapore. And the mistakes he refers to, those are mistakes that could trigger a war between the U.S. and China. But now Trump's administration is saying those rules, they were just, quote, attempts to appease the communist regime in Beijing. No more, says Mike Pompeo. Those rules are now null and void. Now, some say this is dangerous, but others are saying, finally. Bi Kim Chow, Taiwan's representative to the U.S., says this is, quote, decades of discrimination removed. And that sort of talk also resonates back home. A recent rally in Taiwan. They're chanting, fight for Trump. He's got fans there, people who love that he doesn't tiptoe around China. They're thrilled that maybe the U.S. can treat Taiwan more like a real country. America usually limits high-level contact with the island, but now all bets are off. And Chinese state media says, if Pompeo himself dares to go there, get ready for a, quote, avalanche, because his madness will bring annihilation. I asked Drew Thompson if Pompeo's decision is a game changer.
If this decision had been made at the beginning of the administration, then I think the game would have been changed.
But that's the thing. This administration has a week left in office. Pompeo's spokeswoman has already said he won't be visiting Taiwan. And all this can be reversed by the new White House, according to Drew Thompson.
They can either revert back, or ideally the Biden administration takes this opportunity to review how it engages Taiwan.
Hard to say what Biden will do. Trump isn't the only one putting off anti-China vibes. There will be Democrats who like what Pompeo just did, even if they won't admit it publicly.
But you also have to consider how Taiwan interprets these changes and how Taiwan behaves. I mean, the big red line of all is Taiwan declaring independence.
That is the risk. Treat Taiwan like a real country, and its leaders may eventually say, well, if America's really got our back, let's just declare it. We are independent. For now, that scenario still feels like a remote possibility. Whether it becomes more likely will have everything to do with the rules Biden sets when he comes to the White House. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Ambassador William Burns has never worked in an intelligence agency. He's a career Foreign Service officer known for his diplomatic record. So it came as a bit of a surprise to many this week when President-elect Biden tapped Burns as his pick to be the next director of the CIA. Former CIA Director John Brennan was not surprised. He says Biden has good reasons for choosing an experienced diplomat as America's spy chief.
President-elect Biden wants to have a national security team that has worked together before so that they can hit the ground running. Bill brings a combination of experiences as well as the right temperament to deal with these very, very challenging issues.
Yeah, what does that mean, the right temperament? What would the CIA look like under Burns' direction? How do you think it would be different?
He is a soft-spoken individual, but his words carry tremendous weight and influence. I think he's going to be able to explain to the CIA in very clear terms just how their work is going to factor into the national security policymaking process. He has excellent interpersonal skills. He knows and has worked with Avril Haines, the nominee to be Director of National Intelligence, for many years. And so therefore, I think he's going to be able to demonstrate to the CIA workforce that he is going to be able to represent CIA interests as well as be able to present CIA intelligence in a very effective fashion.
So when William Burns steps into that office and looks at that map of the world, what is he looking at? What will be his first priorities?
Clearly, China is going to be a very, very important issue that he's going to have to be engaged in from the very beginning. But also interactions with Russia. We need to make sure that we're able to have a dialogue with Russia so we can deal with issues related to nuclear arms control talks and the Middle East, especially Iran. And given recent developments throughout the Middle East, in Yemen, in Syria, Iraq, and these are areas that Bill Burns has had a lot of experience over the years.
So Gina Haspel is the current director, the first woman to head the agency. She seems to have remained out of the spotlight. How would you describe the agency under her tenure? What kind of culture will William Burns be walking into?
Donald Trump has been very dismissive of intelligence. And I know that CIA officers really feel as though their hard work, their sacrifices are not being used in a manner that really helps to contribute to our national security. So I think with Biden in the White House and Bill Burns at the helm, they're going to be able to realize that the intelligence mission is as critically important as it was before Donald Trump came into office, and their work is going to be appreciated, recognized, and used.
I mean, really? Can the CIA ever be considered apolitical again? I mean, given how radically the role of intelligence gathering has been questioned and challenged in the Trump era.
Yeah, I think the CIA has performed an apolitical function even during the Trump administration. I think Donald Trump has tried to manipulate and exploit the intelligence process. And unfortunately, he's had people like John Ratcliffe and Richard Grenell as directors of national intelligence really cater to his whims. I do believe that Gina Haspel has worked to protect the agency and make sure that it's not going to be used as a pawn in the political process. So I think Bill Burns is going to have to do a lot of listening early on and then make sure that he takes appropriate steps.
I'm wondering if you're at all concerned that President-elect Biden seems to be surrounding himself almost exclusively with people he's had a long career working closely with, people who share his worldview. Do you think he needs more advisors who actually might shake up that worldview?
I do think it's important for him to have a diversity of views and input. And so therefore, I do hope that he is going to look to those individuals who he may not have had much experience with before, because that diversity of views, I think, is so critically important in order for him to make the best and most informed decision.
John Brennan directed the CIA from 2013 to 2017. John Brennan, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We've all heard the news this week. Some of Silicon Valley's social media giants have given President Trump the boot. The moves by the likes of Twitter and Facebook have sparked a global conversation about who has the right to regulate speech and what role the big tech platforms should play in policing the web. The World's Lydia Emanuelidou covers technology for the show and joins me to talk through all this. Lydia, you've been following some of the reactions to the Trump ban by several social media platforms. What are you seeing?
Yeah, so Marco, as you might imagine, there's been a wide range of reactions to this. Some people are applauding the social media platforms for banning Trump, even though they say this should have happened long ago. And then others have some reservations. So, for example, German Chancellor Angela Merkel called this ban problematic, that it should be up to legislators of a country to decide how speech is regulated. This is a critique that we heard from officials in the UK as well as France, this idea that in a democracy, there should be clear laws and regulations around acceptable speech online, and that these decisions should not be left up to tech CEOs.
I mean, even here in the U.S., there are conceptual limits to free speech, the classic formula of not shouting fire in a crowded theater, for example. But it is really complicated. How do other democracies regulate what ends up on social media?
In the U.S., because of U.S. laws, social media platforms are basically immune from being held legally responsible for what users post online. But that's not the case in other parts of the world, like in Europe. And Germany, in particular, leads the way on legislation that cracks down on certain types of online speech. So in 2017, they passed this law that basically says that social media companies have 24 hours to remove hate speech or face huge fines. And now lawmakers in Germany are looking at what happened in the U.S. on Capitol Hill last week and saying this is a reason why we need to strengthen this law.
How would they strengthen it?
Basically, they want social media companies to be required to, when they see cases of hate speech and other criminal activity on their platforms, to take that straight to the federal police in Germany so they can investigate. This is something German lawmakers were debating adding to the law last year. It didn't pass because of privacy concerns. But it's interesting that now, because of what happened in the U.S., some lawmakers in Germany are saying, look, clearly more needs to be done to deal with online speech before it escalates to real-world physical violence.
So going back to that German law you mentioned, the one that was passed in 2017, what is deemed illegal?
Denying the Holocaust, hate speech against minorities. And these are things that Germany outlawed after World War II. And since 2017, they've applied these rules online too. France also tried to pass a similar law last year, cracking down on some of the same things, but that was overturned by the courts there, interestingly enough, because of free speech concerns. So that's one criticism of this kind of legislation. And then another criticism is that it deals with very narrowly defined hate speech and not with things like disinformation, conspiracy theories, all the kind of problematic stuff that experts say helped lead to the Capitol riot last week.
Right, that kind of disinformation and conspiracy theory. So what are countries doing to tackle that? That seems to be really fundamental.
Just last month, the European Commission came out with what's been described as a landmark set of proposals to require social media companies not just to do more to address hate speech and disinformation, but also to be much more transparent about what they're actually doing to deal with some of that on their platforms. Now, they're years away from actually becoming law and being enforced. And until then, a lot of this policing is going to be left up to the private companies themselves to do, even in Europe, which, again, is considered to be well ahead of the U.S.
Clearly something the U.S. is going to have to take a lot more seriously. The World's Lydia Emanuelidou, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
One of the country's most powerful and influential men died late last night. Hotel and casino magnate Sheldon Adelson was 87. Adelson's company, Las Vegas Sands, said the cause of death was complications from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Adelson spent part of his sizable fortune backing conservative candidates and causes, has been a major donor to President Trump. And when it comes to goings-on between Washington and Jerusalem in the past few years, perhaps no single person has had as much behind-the-scenes political sway. To talk about what Adelson represented in U.S.-Israeli politics, Michael Koplow is with me. He's the policy director with Israel Policy Forum in Washington. First of all, Michael, remind us, who was Sheldon Adelson?
Sheldon Adelson was an extremely wealthy American Jew. He spent a lot of money both on politics and on philanthropy in the United States and Israel. And in the United States, he is very closely tied to President Trump in policies that the Trump administration advanced when it came to Israel and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
We should note that Adelson also supported a lot of non-political causes, donating hundreds of millions to medical research and Jewish causes. But his role as a major political donor, how did that transition happen from casinos and real estate to politics? Like, what causes did he take up and why?
He's somebody who always had a very proud Jewish identity, and he was involved in a lot of Jewish organizations that were involved in Israel policy at the outset, from AIPAC to the Republican Jewish Coalition to the Israel-American Council. And in particular, he was a big opponent of the JCPOA.
The Iran nuclear deal. Yeah.
The Iran nuclear deal. Adelson was very vocal in the fact that he thought President Trump should pull the United States out of the deal as soon as he became president. And I think that certainly the fact that he was a big supporter of President Trump doesn't necessarily mean that he convinced President Trump to do it. I think that pulling out of the Iran deal is something that President Trump would have done on his own by all indications. Mm. But Adelson certainly pushed him to do it very heavily.
So if you go down the checklist of other things aside from the JCPOA, what were the major moves regarding Israel and the West Bank under Trump that you think Adelson had a strong hand in?
Moving the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem is the other policy that Adelson is most associated with. He felt very strongly that the United States should recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital, and Adelson is widely credited for backing that move and pushing that move.
So Benjamin Netanyahu said today he had deep sorrow and heartbreak over Adelson's death. How influential was Adelson among other Israeli leaders, and what was his overall reputation in Israel?
One of the things that I think is most interesting about Adelson is that he is probably as well known in Israel as he is in the United States. He was an enormous philanthropist to Israeli causes. He was a multi-million donor to Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial. He was also a big funder of Birthright, which is an organization that brings American Jews on trips to Israel and is credited with strengthening the American Jewish connection to Israel. And so many Israeli leaders view him as a big supporter of Israel and of Israeli philanthropic causes. But aside from that, he is very much associated with Prime Minister Netanyahu, largely because he was the owner of Yisrael Hayom, which is the largest circulation newspaper in Israel. And it's effectively seen as state media in Netanyahu's service. In some ways, this is Adelson's largest impact inside of Israel, in that he now, for over a decade, has made what is essentially a multi-million dollar annual campaign contribution to Netanyahu.
Michael Koplow is the policy director with Israel Policy Forum in Washington, speaking with us about the late Sheldon Adelson. Michael, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to The World. Growing your own food has risen in popularity during the pandemic, but it's about more than getting something to eat.
The great, great majority of our populations are disconnected from our food systems. So I think it's about growing food and the visibility of that.
Knowing your food. Also ahead, the global toll of the pandemic on school children on the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We come to you from GBH Boston and PRX. On Thursday, millions of Ugandans will go to the polls to vote for president. At the helm is the incumbent, Yoweri Museveni, a former guerrilla fighter who ousted two dictators. He's now been in power for more than 30 years. Museveni is up against a number of candidates, but the man at the forefront is a singer and politician, Bobby Wine. The World's Africa correspondent, Halima Gikandi, is in Uganda's capital, Kampala. So the vote's coming up in a couple of days, Halima. What is the pre-election atmosphere like?
This has been an election that people have been watching because it's so symbolic of what seems to be happening in the region. You have a young population against kind of the old guard. On one hand is President Museveni, and his campaign slogan has been "Secure Your Future." And on the other side is somebody half his age, Bobi Wine, and his slogan has been "A New Uganda." And that kind of seems to be the crux of what we're hearing people say. But other than that, there have been real logistical challenges here, namely a slowdown of the internet and restrictions on social media. In fact, during a presidential address today, President Museveni actually admitted that the government was blocking or restricting access to social media platforms like Facebook that impacts ordinary people as well as journalists like myself.
There are also concerns, Halima, about violence. What are people worried about specifically?
Well, violence from security forces as well as excessive force. We've seen at least dozens of people at demonstrations or caught in the crosshairs of demonstrations who have been killed, especially a couple months back. And this is also impacting mainly opposition leaders like Bobi Wine as well as members of his party and other opposition parties. In fact, during an interview this morning with a local Kenyan radio station, Bobi Wine was interrupted, and this is what he had to say.
I'm sorry, even right now as we speak, we are being raided by the military. I have to end the interview because I can see soldiers beating my security guard.
That is pretty dramatic.
Yeah, and this isn't the first time. Last week I was on a press call with Bobi Wine and the same thing happened. During the middle of the interview, you see security officials essentially pulling him out of the vehicle. And this has kind of characterized this entire campaign season here. And I spoke with one human rights lawyer here. His name is Peter Magella, and he works with Chapter 4 Uganda, which is an NGO. And this is what he had to say about this election.
From the human rights perspective, there has been a bit of high-handedness, torture, arrest. A number of cases have been reported where people have disappeared.
And I asked Magella, okay, where does this seem to be coming from? And he says that all signs point to the top, as in President Museveni.
So what has been the government's response to this violence and these allegations against President Museveni?
It's been mostly unapologetic. I mean, the government has really mostly accused the opposition of being these troublemakers, of undermining the election, of inciting people to go against the election, of ignoring COVID health regulations that we've seen that have essentially restricted in-person campaigning. Today I spoke with the government spokesperson, Afuano Opondo, and this is what he had to say about members of the opposition.
Opposition leaders, opposition people in Uganda, they think that simply by virtue of being a presidential candidate, some rules don't apply to you. Traffic rules apply 100%. So if you are going to drive recklessly, you will be stopped by traffic police and charged.
What he's talking about there is if you're here in Kampala, what you'll see, or rather what you'll hear first, are these trucks zooming around, blasting music and campaign slogans. But many have pointed out that these rules aren't being applied equally. These rules that are ostensibly for COVID reasons, i.e. limiting in-person contact, are actually only impacting certain people in this campaign, or that's the allegation.
And finally, Halima, what are ordinary Ugandans you meet on the streets as you walk around? What are they saying about this election?
Really, the biggest concern I've seen on all sides is about violence and insecurity. And this is something I hear expressed on the radio and on TV. Some people have actually left Kampala to go vote in their rural homes, but also because they want to be away from Kampala. This is the center of support for Bobi Wine. So if the election swings in the opposite direction, we could see demonstrations or protest against the outcome followed by heavy crackdown. And today, President Museveni warned against any disruption and said, the army is strong, the army can protect people, the army is here. The question is that reassuring for people, or is that going to be something that scares people and keeps them at home?
The world's Halima Gikandi speaking with us from Kampala, the Ugandan capital. Thanks very much. Good to speak.
Thank you, Marco.
About a year ago, we first met Adela Diaz on the campus of the University of Arizona.
My parents always wanted me to do well in school, and like they instilled in me that hard work pays off, so I've always just tried my hardest.
Adela voted for the first time in November's presidential election. We followed her journey to the polls as part of our series Every 30 Seconds, looking at the young Latino electorate in the U.S. Reporter Michelle Marisco from KJZZ in Tucson tells us what's next for Adela Diaz.
I'm going to be honest with you. There was a moment on election night where everything was just seemed very bleak.
That November 3rd night, with voter numbers split, electoral votes falling to both candidates, and President Donald Trump ahead in key states, Adela Diaz was tense.
The margins were too close, and then I had to go to bed, you know. I had school the next day, so, and not that that would have done me any good to stay up, because we didn't get any real news for a few more days.
One event that wasn't in doubt by late that night, Arizona was heading blue. For the first time in decades, it would have two Democrat senators.
My vote for a Democrat, my state that traditionally goes Republican, not doing that, that felt so good.
I spoke with Adela and her parents, Debbie and George, as I have so many times during 2020 via Zoom. Right before the new year, I wanted to ask them, what do you want from 2021?
We need peace.
That's Adela's mom, Debbie Diaz.
You know, that's the biggest take from all of this was how divided everyone is, whether it's family, friends. You may not have friends anymore. You may have conflicts with your family, all because of this.
And for Adela?
Hopefully, we won't all be locked up in our houses in the next election. I won't freak out when someone with a petition tries to approach me and their mask isn't on right.
So Adela's party of choice won, but she was primarily an Elizabeth Warren supporter a year ago. Today, she remains less ecstatic with the Democrats choosing Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. It's a common refrain from many young Latino voters I spoke to, anyone but Trump.
Unfortunately, I have to go with what the DNC wants me to go with. So if they end up choosing Kamala as their candidate, then yes, she will have my vote in 2024.
Adela's dad, George Diaz, hopes when that next election comes, Latinos aren't just lumped together into some assumed voter group.
Our priorities are much like everybody else's priorities. We want to be safe. We want to have good schools. We want to have dependable infrastructure. I don't think anybody can argue with that.
He hopes that will lead to more effective outreach in the 2022 midterms. With the elections behind her, Adela is turning her focus to college. She just began her second year as a public health major, and all but one of her classes is online this semester, which is why Adela continues to be extremely interested in health disparities, more so now after seeing the impacts of the pandemic on Black and Brown communities.
You hate to watch it happen, but again, what kind of people are essential workers? Many of them are low-income people of color. Who was disproportionately affected? Essential workers. People living in multifamily homes. People who can't necessarily quarantine without hurting their other family members. You know, that's just not the kind of luxury that they have.
The virus and a wild, deadly election year laid those realities bare.
And now a year later, I feel the same, just more passionate, for sure.
For the world, I'm Michel Marisco in Tucson.
We have Michel Marisco joining us now from his home studio in Tucson. Hey, Michel.
Hey, Marco.
So that was a really nice check-in there with Adela Diaz and her parents, hearing their hopes for the future. Why did you feel it was important for you to include everyone, Adela and her parents, Debbie and George, in this final update?
When I first met Adela, and it now feels like it was so long ago, it was just a little bit less than a year ago. We had started this communication, and her relationship with her parents was really important to her, to the point where, you know, they would call her during her interviews and talk about different dynamics of the political race at that time. So it just seemed like a natural fit for, you know, this is how we started. It was a really nice way to sort of wrap it all up.
So as election years go, 2020 obviously was a crazy one, a historic year. And I really hope first-time voters know it's not normally this difficult. I'm just curious, though, how did Adela keep up with all of that? The pandemic, the protests, Washington dysfunction, especially as a first-time voter.
Right. It started becoming this real fast download of information for her all the time. It was, you know, I would do an interview with her about the 16 candidates, if we can all go back that far in history, who first wanted to run for the Democratic ticket. And then all of a sudden, you know, there was explosions throughout the country as outrage grew over the George Floyd killings, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and I would almost feel like my interviews had to be redone with her and our conversations had to be redone because it seemed like the news was happening so fast.
There was also a lot of youth voter enthusiasm in Arizona, where you are, as well as in many other states. What was your biggest takeaway, Michelle, when it came to young Latinos voting this year, especially when it comes to the energy?
A few things there. Yes, the young Latinos. And here in Arizona, it was a marvel to watch. There were 40% new Latino voters in 2020 compared to 2016. That's according to Voto Latino. And 75% of those Latino voters here in Arizona voted for Joe Biden. It was just a vast, vast outpouring of support there for the Democratic ticket.
Michelle Marisco, our Every 30 Seconds reporter in Tucson, Arizona. Michelle, thanks as always for being with us. It was great final checking with you.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Take a moment and head over to theworld.org and explore all the voices and stories in our Every 30 Seconds project. Our reporting on the influential and diverse voices of young Latino voters span the entire election cycle. Meantime, our election coverage continues as the U.S. faces the test of making a peaceful transition of power while people around the globe watch and wait. All of that reporting is online for you at theworld.org. 10 years ago, the uprisings across North Africa and the Middle East shook the globe. Tunisians were the first to demonstrate against years of dictatorship, and their president Zine El Abidine Ben Ali was the first of several strongmen during the Arab uprisings to be deposed. That happened 10 years ago this week. On January 11th, 2011, a little less than a month after the uprising began in Tunisia, a large peaceful demonstration in the center of the capital, Tunis. The woman singing here is Emel Matlouti. She's surrounded by thousands of people in the street. She's holding a candle and singing Kemti Ora, My Word is Free, her song that would become Tunisia's anthem of change. Emel was visiting her home country at the time and did not expect to be caught up in a momentous chapter of history.
I definitely identify now as a Tunisian-American, Arab-American, definitely a New Yorker for sure.
Emel recorded her latest album, Tunis Diaries, last year in self-quarantine in Tunis. Organically, the songs became a reflection of the revolution 10 years prior. Emel Matlouti explains.
By some miracle in December 2010, I found myself close to the south in the town of Sfax. And I had a show, and during the day we heard what was happening in Sidi Bouzid and what happened with Mohamed Bouazizi, who set himself on fire as a protest against life under a very oppressive regime. So I immediately reacted and I dedicated a song for him on stage. His courage and his tragic gesture brought so much strength in people. So I was in Tunis starting March 2020, and confinement became official, I think, the third part of March. I actually felt that it was maybe the right time for me to just unpack my bags and enjoy my childhood home where I grew up, where I developed my first emotions, my first passion for music and for singing. I started recording the Tunis Diaries, and I selected three songs of each of my previous three albums. And at the same time, I decided to start recording also the covers of songs that influenced me and inspired me as I was growing up. There's a song called Libertad, which means freedom. It's actually a rap song that was written by very political rappers in Tunisian, and I wrote a melody for it. It speaks, for example, about like how portraits of the dictator were all over the place. It was the old normal. And I think it's very interesting to still perform it today with the same lyrics, to remember how far we've come from there. But at the same time, there's glimpses to things that didn't change that much. I will always represent hope. Hope is my name, and there isn't something more beautiful or more honorable that any artist or any human being could wish than bring hope to people around you.
Tunisian singer Emel Matlouti. By the way, the annual International Music Festival, Global Fest, is not happening in person this year, but it is happening online all this week. Tonight is the second night of Global Fest, and Emel is performing. You can catch her set and the three other shows tonight at globalfest.org. You're listening to The World. If you really want to understand the social impact of the pandemic, consider this. Across the globe, more than 200 million kids are not in school and are now learning remotely. That's about 1 in 8 students worldwide, according to UNESCO. For Mira Levinson, a professor of education at Harvard, one thing has become increasingly clear.
We're just seeing an ever-increasing exacerbation of inequality.
Levinson spoke with us today as part of our regular Facebook Live discussions, which we co-sponsor with Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Levinson says schools are more than a place to learn. They offer social support and, for many kids, a place to get a meal. During the pandemic, schools in lower-income countries have been more likely to shut down. Here in the U.S., as many as a third of public school students may have not set foot in the classroom since last March. That's widening academic gaps as well as the social and emotional well-being of children.
Absolutely, getting kids back to school has to be the priority. Getting them back to school safely.
So the balance has changed, and there's sort of a mantra now that schools should be the last to close and the first to open.
That's Levinson's husband, infectious disease specialist Mark Lipsitch, also with Harvard. Lipsitch says as scientists around the world continue to learn more about this new coronavirus, they're finding that kids are at a lower risk of contracting and spreading the disease.
At least the younger grades are typically not major foci of transmission.
Lipsitch says keeping schools open safely means better ventilation and ensuring that teachers can get vaccinated. He cautions, though, things could change if a new variant of the coronavirus dramatically increases transmission rates. Regardless, Mira Levinson stresses this, opening up the actual school buildings, that's just the first step back. She says it's going to take some serious money to get things back on track here in the U.S.
There's also going to have to be, I think, a multi-billion, perhaps, you know, close to $1 trillion investment, I think, by the federal government over the next few years.
To hear and watch more from our Facebook Live discussion about schools, safety, and the pandemic's global impact, head on over to theworld.org. The pandemic has changed a lot about how we interact with our environment. I know that if I didn't have a daily walk or a jog outside, lockdown would be really grim. So now food activists and researchers are encouraging people to rethink, long-term, how outdoor public land can be used. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on the growing push for edible public spaces.
Edible public spaces can come in a lot of different shapes and sizes. A community garden is one example. Some have animals, some are plants only. These landscapes can be big, like a university campus in northern China made largely of rice fields, or a five-acre forest of fruits, vegetables, and herbs in Malaysia. But other edible public spaces are small and simple.
Say if we go to some of the countries in the Mediterranean, let's say Spain or Italy, we might see citrus trees lining a street side.
Joshua Zoinart is a landscape architect and professor at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. He's been looking into edible public spaces for more than a decade and says while the landscapes are centered around food, feeding people isn't always the primary goal.
I think it's more so about connecting urban citizens with our food systems. And, you know, the great, great majority of our populations are disconnected from our food systems. So I think it's about bringing growing food and the visibility of that into our consciousness so that we don't lose connection.
Strengthening that relationship through a decentralized food system could also lead to a reduction in food waste, Zoinart says. When people realize how hard it is to grow food, they likely won't throw produce away as readily. Another benefit is the social connections made in these spaces.
The language is in the plant in some ways.
Chris Blythe heads up a UK charity called Social Farms and Gardens. Pre-pandemic, he recalls dinners with community garden members from around the world. Using the same garden or farm, they'd all prepare meals from their hometown or country.
Jamaican dishes, Polish dishes, beetroot soup and sauerkraut, plus a traditional English barbecue of sausage. You know, it's such an opportunity to share different cultures.
For other edible public spaces, though, feeding people is the main purpose.
To me, the biggest benefit would be that people can access nutritious food on a daily basis.
John Chiwagalo works at Slow Food Uganda. His team helps more than 1,500 people get seeds, tools, and gardening training to plant their own plots on urban rooftops.
We also reach out to schools to teach kids how to grow food and the importance of growing food. And you find that kids are working with their parents to grow food. They are actively engaged as children.
Chiwagalo says that education became vital during the pandemic as income insecurity rose and people were forced to stay home with less frequent trips to the market. Slow Food Uganda used this year to highlight the need for edible spaces on public land and in urban homes.
So it was an opportunity to have people understand that having gardens at home is an essential practice whereby you can access food even without having money for buying food from markets.
Lockdown also inspired an edible public space in the French city of Le Havre, where they created a free fruit, vegetable, and herb garden in front of City Hall. Passersby know when to pick the produce with the help of small signs in the dirt that say, "I'm ripe," or "Wait a bit." This huge range of what public food landscapes can look like and what benefits they provide is diversity that many people celebrate. But Chris Blythe in the UK says that variation can also make the concept tough for policymakers to grasp.
If you go to a policymaker and sort of say, right, well, this space will benefit the local community, it will benefit the public health system, it will benefit the economic and employment development areas, that's great, but where do I put my money? That's great, but what's the key benefit? And explaining and eliciting that key benefit to a policymaker is quite a challenge.
Blythe says policy surrounding these spaces remains largely untouched. He hopes future laws will clear some of the red tape that prevents people from using public land to grow free, accessible produce. In the meantime, edible spaces continue to grow in demand and popularity, making it easier for people in cities around the world to get their hands dirty. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Yep, I've got some rooftop Italian parsley from last summer that I moved inside, and it is doing great. It's not much, but it makes all the difference. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online 24/7 at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.